So thank you very much for the invitation. I feel I'm really happy to be back here at the Institute, and also in particular at this conference. I've been just been thrilled with the talk so far, so it's just really great to be here. Thanks very much. I'm gonna work this manually. So I do realize that, like the previous speaker, I'm this is a very broad audience. So let me give you a lightning-fast introduction to cosmology. So here's all of cosmology on one slide. And the key concepts that we'll be coming back to is that we are here today, and what I'm showing here is our past light cone. So everything that you see when you look out into the universe lives on the surface of this cone. Time backwards runs like this. Space runs like this. Okay, so a light ray travels at this angle on this diagram. As we look back, as we look at light that's traveled for longer and longer periods of times, we look back into the past. In fact, we can't help but look back into the past, simply because light takes time to travel. And as we look back into the past, we see various types of observables. Most of these we have now seen. Some of these still remain to be discovered, but actually these spectral distortions, for example, haven't been seen. The neutrino background has only been seen indirectly. Primordial gravitational waves have not yet been seen, but are a subject of people are searching for those. And those observables here probe the history of the universe, and here's a physical history. Here's the end of the beginning. Radiation dominates at early times. The elements are created for a while. Radiation continues to dominate. At some point, the energy balance of the universe, at some point, matter takes over because it, as the universe expands, matter, the energy density in matter goes down more slowly than the radiation density. Then at some point, the universe becomes neutral. Before it was a plasma, and transparent to light. So the universe stops being opaque after this point in time here. Then at some point, the first stars form, so structure lights up. The light from those stars reionizes the universe. It's an energetic light. Then there's another milestone in the history of the universe where some mysterious thing happens that we do not understand, and the universe begins to accelerate while it has been decelerating all the way since the beginning. So that's your cosmology course in 2 minutes. To make this even more visual, let me show you what happens to a photon after this point in time here that the universe becomes transparent to light. Before that, it's full of charged particles, and kind of the job of a photon is to scatter off of charged particles. So after these charged particles, photons and electrons combine into hydrogen, the universe becomes transparent. So let's have a look at the journey of such a photon through space and time. Okay, so here is a map of this oldest light that we see, the afterglow of the Big Bang, the cosmic microwave background. And what we will go into the time of the universe before this light was emitted. Here's a bunch of photons scattering off of electrons and protons in the primordial plasma. And as the universe expands, the universe cools and you get hydrogen forming. And so suddenly these photons are able to free stream. As they free stream, at some point stars start forming. There was a dark age. Here stars form, galaxies form, and the photon redshifts. It loses energy because the universe expands. As it is traveling through these structures, actually the path of it gets deviates because of gravitational lensing, so general relativistic effect. If it encounters a free electron by chance along its path, it might change direction. And as it travels forward, being gravitationally lensed, eventually it comes to the Milky Way, and after 13.7 billion years, its glorious end is to be absorbed by one of the detectors of this Planck space mission. And so this is, and here's the Earth. And just to help you visualize some of the maps I'll be showing later, here you see the Earth visualized in front of the map of the cosmic microwave background in the background. Oh, okay, so it doesn't turn into the map. Anyway, I'll explain that later. Okay, so now you've seen a global picture of the universe, and you've followed a photon as it has traveled through most of the history of the universe. So this is the data set that we're working with, mostly photons, and all the information that we have lives in on the surface of and inside of that past light cone. So what makes learning from cosmic structure exciting? Why is this an interesting field that I might talk about in front of a general audience? Just the fact that we can learn from this. It's an interesting statistics problem because there's a lot of data. There's actually been a Moore's law for astrophysical data volumes that's been working, that's been going on for decades. And given what we already know, this will persist for at least another decade. And another thing that's quite special in astrophysics and cosmology is that we work, at least for a lot of what we do, we work on very solid theoretical foundations. So we can often formulate very good prior information, often in the form of hierarchical models, where we say, we start with some prior, then that implies something else, that implies something else, and so forth. We can reason down the chain in an inference. And these have strong physical motivation. So we have the power of physics on our side. This was a little bit different from, for example, in biology, where it's very easy to go back and do experiments, but there's a complexity of phenomena that at least here, in a certain way, we can sort of compartmentalize the complexity of phenomena. I'll get back to that in a minute. So here's just, you're not going to get a quiz on this, but just to show these are all surveys that are either ongoing or have just completed, but most of them are actually in the future, just to show that we live in the era of the time where we chart the cosmos with very large telescopes, very high resolution experiments to look at this cosmic microwave background, space instruments that are planned, being constructed to be launched in about 3-4 years, something like that. This is one that just finished, the Planck satellite. And so all of these instruments and space missions and telescopes observe is this large hierarchy of scales. So I showed you, here's this map of the cosmic microwave background. The reason that it's egg-shaped is not because it looks like an egg, but obviously because it covers the celestial sphere. And in order to show you that on a plane, I have to cut it open and stretch it, just like an Earth map. So when you then zoom into some, just to give you a sense of the range of scales that we observe, you start with this all-sky map. If you take a distance from one side of the sky to the other, that length scale is essentially the size of the observable universe. Then you zoom in on a patch like this, take a small part of that, zoom in again. Then you get roughly to the size of sort of the current state of the art of galaxy surveys. If you take another patch like this, you zoom in, take another patch like this, zoom in again, you get to a scale where you start seeing here these kinds of filamentary structures, the so-called cosmic web. This is now the density of galaxies, observed density of galaxies. And then here you get to the point where, that dot here is the Milky Way. So this is one galaxy, and it shows you roughly the scale of the observable universe. On this, if you remember that picture here, essentially as you go down in scale, you're observing first the cosmic microwave background and then, later slices of this past light cone. So this is the data side of things. So this is the set of observables. And now let me try to convince you that there is the modeling side is also interesting. So where does all the structure come from? We have good reason to believe that the structure was created or is actually the result of quantum fluctuations, vacuum fluctuations in the primordial universe. And here's a simple cartoon simulation of how on a uniform background these fluctuations will be imprinted, starting from large scales and going to smaller and smaller scales. This is a movie where the expansion of the universe has been taken out. So you see that the scales first get imprinted on large scales and then on short scales. So when this happens, the rolling of the quantum dice in the early universe gives rise to this object here. This is a 3D ball, and in fact here you can see it's the base of this light cone. Okay, so this is the set of initial conditions that then get processed through physics into everything that we see. Okay. So this is the initial conditions, this is, the quantum mechanical fluctuations that sourced all structure later on. So without these, there'd be nothing to look at in the universe. It would just be a homogeneous and isotropic universe. Okay? So this is key because this, from these primordial perturbations, we can then predict they get processed into these observations through radiative transfer, gravity, and just astrophysics. This gives rise to all of these observables. So cosmic microwave background, the distribution of density in the universe. Thank you to the previous speaker for showing a movie of how that gets assembled. And all the other observables that we can use to trace all the structure. Okay, so really I hope you're starting to get this global perspective of what we're trying to do, trying to reconstruct the initial conditions, and together with physics, this predicts everything we observe in the universe. So here's an example of how we take this kind of initial condition, okay, like that, which we can check against this early slice, okay, on this past light cone, and connect it to observations of this through theory. So here's what's so-called n-body simulation. So this shows how these small initial perturbations, very small initial perturbations, start growing into structures. And these nodes here harbor clusters of galaxies today. You see there are voids, filaments of dark matter that connect these nodes. So you see there's quite a rich kind of structure that that is created through gravitational attraction. Okay, this is structure formation under gravity. So if you want to learn from this, or what do we want to learn from this? The questions that we want to ask are about fundamental physics. We're interested in the content of the universe. Okay, what is the particle content? What is dark matter? What are the neutrino physics? All those things that go beyond the standard model for which we have evidence, and the original evidence in most of these cases actually comes from astronomical observations. The dark energy that it seems to be driving the acceleration of the universe. We want to learn about what happened at the beginning, what's the physics of the beginning at these very high energies, which complements collider experiments on Earth, this different regime. It's challenging to do this, and here's sort of a unique set of features, not every one of those is unique, but I think in their combination. Even though we have all of this data, in fact, it's only one universe to look at. So there's this situation where we can't replicate the experiment very easily. You can't go back and just do it again. There's one universe in order to get out the information. So we have to be very careful in treating our uncertainties, because on the largest scales of the universe, there's just a few set of precious modes that we have to probe the very earliest epochs of structure formation on these very large scales, which were created first, as I showed you in that movie. On smaller scales, where most of the Fourier modes live, just to count the number of modes, most of them are small scale, they are nonlinear. I've just shown you how under gravitational collapse, these initial small light linear fluctuations turn into large clusters of galaxies and quite strong nonlinear objects. High densities, densities of thousands, 10,000, and so forth. At the same time, you do have large data sets, but they're observational rather than experimental and often indirect. So we have a lot of information, but we need to interpret the information because we can't turn a galaxy around and look at it from the other side on the sky. You know, we just see whatever we get offered. It's sort of found data at some level. Just like in any other science, we have to deal with systematics, things that contaminate the data. You know, one person's systematics is another person's science. you know, you're looking at a galaxy. As a cosmologist, I'd like to treat a galaxy just like a little point that traces the mass, but that's not what it is. There's a lot of stuff going on. A lot of people, it's very, very interesting physics, but okay. And then there's instrumental and observational effects that can skew what you're looking at, and you have to be very careful. Selection effects, you know, the fact that when you look into the universe, the first thing you see are the brightest objects, for example. You have to take that into account when you interpret this, and so forth. So now we get to machine learning after this introduction. Why do people do machine learning in cosmology? Part of it is automation. Since we have these very large data sets, it means that we can't really do manual intervention. We use it for acceleration and for superhuman performance, basically. Those are the three main use cases. When trained on physical models and data, you know, sometimes you can get emergent algorithms. We've seen examples of that in the last couple of days. Where these emergent trained networks actually beat designed algorithms. And physical simulations, because of the variety and the manifold phenomena in these simulations, they can be quite costly. So let me now give you a few examples of machine learning in cosmology. For example, there are these exploding stars called supernovae, of which we will soon have hundreds of thousands or even a million. Here's an example of one. See next to a galaxy, it briefly shines roughly with the light of a galaxy. This exploding star turns out to be very useful to cosmology because you can use it as a standard candle. You know, you can infer how luminous it is, and from knowing the luminosity and knowing how bright it appears in the sky, you know how far away it is. So you can use it as a distance measurement. Now, typing, there are a bunch of these different ones. Some of them, the type 1As, are standard candles. You can use that way. The other types, not so much. But sometimes they're difficult to tell apart when all you have is seeing them through a bunch of color filters, you know, typically six color filters. What you really want is a spectrum of all of the light, and you can see certain lines and tell what type it is. But that's just far too expensive. It takes a lot of time to collect all the photons to make a spectrum. And you cannot do this for 100,000 or a million objects. You know, they happen, you have to go there, otherwise they're gone. They shine for a few weeks and that's it. So can you use machine learning to identify the types? So here's a paper by a member of my group, Tom Charnock, who looked at a bidirectional recurrent neural network to look at observations of a supernova in these different color bands, these wideband photometric observations. And the output is a probability that in fact it is a type 1A supernova. And so as the supernova progresses, at some point you reach a certainty in this particular case. You can use it to flag these supernova and go and do follow-up while they're still bright. Another application, actually the first serious application of neural networks in astronomy, there have been machine learning applications before, but neural networks, was the inference of how far away an object is based on how much light has been redshifted on its way towards us through the expansion of the universe. And there the intrinsic difficulty, I'm just showing that mostly to highlight this problem which occurs quite often in cosmology, and I want you, please tell me if you have ideas for how to solve it, which is that when we train these networks, we train them with objects where we know the redshift very well because we have spectroscopic information, and then we want to predict the redshift from just these wideband observations, okay, just the colors of the object. The problem is that typically the spectra are from nearby objects, and the large data sets will be from very far away objects, and they don't necessarily have the same properties. So you have the unavoidable situation where you have out of class training data, and you somehow have to generalize it to being able to classify things or do a regression of things that you haven't seen yet. This acceleration aspect, there are emulators. I'm going to skip over this in the interest of time, but this is very widely used because you have quite complicated calculations that you can accelerate. Here's an example of a high precision prediction for the cosmic microwave background power spectrum that tells us a lot about the properties of the universe. This gives you a 10,000 times speed up to be able to do. This is the workhorse for the Planck parameter estimates that now tell us what the properties of the universe are. This actually does not use neural networks. Turns out for this problem, it's actually much better to just do a simple regression than the sort of locally adaptive method. The accuracy requirements are very high, and you get very good generalization, basically, because you're training just a simple regression in a dimensionally reduced space globally over the entire range of parameters. Here are examples for emulators that emulate the statistical properties of these nonlinearly evolved density fields under gravity. Those calculations that I showed you a movie of just before of the structure forming are very time consuming. And so here, the idea is to essentially predict what these power spectra look like just from the initial conditions directly as a function of the cosmological parameters. And here's an example of the 1% error bar that will soon be the observational precision and the kind of precision that we're able to reach with these emulators. This is an older emulator. This is the range that is now the best in class. This is a more ambitious type of emulator here, using neural networks in this case. This is by Hay and Shirley Ho's group at the Flatiron Institute, where based on a perturbation theory prediction of this nonlinear collapse, so in a regime where you sort of do the first step using perturbation theory before the densities get very high, and then you correct it with a machine-learned algorithm, a very large network that then takes in the perturbation theory and calculates the nonlinear correction to it. Shows that, this is first and second order perturbation theory, the residuals in the particle locations at the end of the simulation. So this actually does the full 3D thing. Here's the residual compared to a full calculation when you take the first order perturbation and then correct it with the machine learned nonlinear correction. This is using a UNET, quite a deep network. This is a test case. This is not really meant for production, but what is interesting from a machine learning point of view is that this appears to be able to generalize for cases where it has not been trained. So in cosmologies that are not part of the training set, so maybe what's going on is that there's some universal aspect to how structure forms, how this cosmic web forms out of the initial small-scale perturbations that the network understands. There are generators in cosmology as well, in astronomy. So here's an example of galaxy images, telescope images of galaxies being generated. This is the typical thing. So you can decide, make up yourselves, you decide for yourselves which one you think is real, which one is fake. Who's for the left? Who thinks it's the left? Who thinks it's the right? Are those fake, you think? No, actually, the left one is the fake one. The right one is the real one in this particular case. I can tell because this is the kernel has a little boundary effect there. So this is how I know. Now I've given it away. Now you will never be fooled again with this kind of question. So coming to the question of, you know, is there a conflict between machine learning? There's quite a lot of skepticism in the community, you know, what if, you know, these black boxes, and on the other hand, you know, physics with Lagrangians and principled statistics and so forth. So let me tell you about a physics-based machine learning technique where that actually implements this forward model, starting from these initial fluctuations all the way to the nonlinear universe today. It's a fully generative probabilistic model of galaxy surveys that has, you know, of the order of 10 to the 7 parameters, which we call BORG, Bayesian origin reconstruction from galaxies. And the way that what this does is it starts with a Gaussian process, not a Gaussian prior for the initial conditions, which is motivated physically from these quantum fluctuations. It's actually good reason to assume it. Then has the gravitational evolution in it, and then says, based on that final evolved state, predicts where galaxies would form in this predicted density distribution. This includes quite a sophisticated model of the survey that you're analyzing and so forth. It then explores the range of possible initial conditions that are consistent with what you see on your light cone, the actual galaxy positions, using Hamiltonian Markov chain Monte Carlo. Operationally what happens is you get a bunch of observations. So here's the galaxy catalog, you stick it into BORG, and then it infers the dark matter densities at an early time, redshift 100, the initial conditions, and generates samples from that. Okay, you've seen in some of the talks we were talking about prediction. So rather than predicting an average, you're actually sampling from a distribution. This distribution is actually the rigorous distribution that you know we can write down analytically in this problem. And we sample from it using Hamiltonian Markov chain Monte Carlo. You can then average these samples and you get these reconstructions of what we know about the initial conditions from the data. But because each sample is actually a full history of the universe, you also have reconstructions of the dark matter density today. And I can show you an example of that in a minute. There's actually no neural networks in here, except one could say for gravity, which you could call a 20-layer 3D neural network, convolutional neural network that respects symplectic Hamiltonian flow, energy, and mass conservation. And in fact, it's an n-body code with 20 time steps, which you can think of as 20 layers in a network, right? And just that all of the weights and biases and so forth are just taken from the Lagrangian. They're not learned, okay? So in that sense, but the learning happens quantitatively here in terms of these very high dimensional posterior PDFs that are sampled from. So let me show you a quick movie that shows the result of this. Okay, let me start this here. So here's a slice through a three-dimensional distribution of galaxies from a survey, and then this movie actually goes over samples in this Markov chain, and the fluctuations correspond to regions where you don't have data, okay, where there's uncertainty. The amount of fluctuation is the uncertainty. And then here, for example, you see that they're very stable reconstructions of these filaments and so forth that connect up these clumps that you see here. And here are the initial conditions. And if you stare at this a long time, you see that there are a lot of stable features here that are reconstructed. So this is our universe, and this is a sample of the set of initial conditions that could have given rise to the galaxy positions in the sky that we observe. Okay, so it's a constrained set of constrained realizations. Start this again. So this gives every sample gives you a full evolution history that then hits where the galaxies are today. And this gives you all kinds of dynamical information and so forth that you can then use to test the model. Let me skip over that. So this is a case where we have this full Bayesian analysis machinery where we do these constrained simulations, constrained on the observations to explore the posterior. But what if we can only do, that we have specified the likelihood, you know, in a lot of detail and the prior and so forth. So what if we can only do forward simulations? We start with the initial conditions, a random set of initial conditions, and evolve it forward. Can we do inference then? This is much easier operationally if you only have to do forward simulations, because you don't have to arrange for your simulation to hit in some high-dimensional space, you know, the position of the data. So here's likelihood-free inference. A quick overview of what that is. You have a set of parameters. You simulate a data set, for example, 3D density from those parameters. You then extract some features. This is your simulated data. You then compare those features with the real data features. And if they are the same, up to some epsilon in some distance measure that you can define, then you accept those parameters that you drew from the prior. If they're not, you reject the parameters and you go again. And in the limit where epsilon goes to zero, then the samples, the retained parameter samples, are a sample of the posterior PDF. So the goal here, because we're doing these forward simulations, you have to hit the data. The question is, how do you reduce the dimensionality of that? Because that will improve your success rate exponentially. And then how do you explore the parameter space? These are the two big questions in likelihood-free inference. So the idea for the reduction of data space is to do massive compression. For example, you can generate a large set of summary statistics to make sure you can take all of the information. Then you can reduce this down to just n compressed statistics that contain all of the information about your n parameters. And this is guaranteed by the information inequality. So if I measure information as Fisher information, then by compressing to the score, I can guarantee that I maintain Fisher information. And so I can always reduce as complicated a data set as I like down to just n parameter numbers that contain all the Fisher information. So this is important because it gets rid of, it solves this dimensional, the curse of dimensionality. The other part is the exploration of parameter space. So I'll just demonstrate what we've done there. So typically what you do is you simulate forward and you then just retain data simulations. When you draw from the prior, simulate forward, retain data simulations where they hit close to the data, to the true data. Okay, and then that slice here gives you your posterior PDF. The there are various tricks for, you know, rather than sampling from the prior, which might give you a lot of misses, you only sample from the region that is likely to give you success of modeling your actual data. There are these techniques called population Monte Carlo, where you actually have a proposal that tries to hit close to where the data, close to the true parameters, rather than simulating from parameters that are going to be excluded anyway. But the difficulty with that is that even for a very large number of simulations, even when you do this dimensionality reduction, you still, the blue contours here are, this is for a case where it can be done kind of exactly and using this likelihood-free inference. Typically for likelihood-free inference, you get these, using these techniques, you get posterior PDFs that are much wider than the actual posterior, than the exact posterior, and that's even with millions of simulations. So you're losing information at that level. So we've been investing our time on density estimation likelihood-free inference, or DELFI, which where the idea is that you take your compressed data and you can take your parameters and you make a 2n dimensional space, and then you model the joint PDF of those two, and then you have this kind of pure Bayesian situation where if you model that joint density, then any data set that you get, just you need to slice through this at some level. So you lose the notion of an epsilon, which leads to this this broadening of the posteriors in the previous case, the sort of traditional likelihood for inference. There's no epsilon anymore. You just have to make sure that you regress this density from the simulations, these forward simulations correctly. So here's an example. This is supernovas, doing cosmology with supernovas. This is the 2n dimensional space, a corner plot of the full joint density of data and parameters. So I showed you the previous example that had 3 million simulations. This is of order 1,000, so a few thousand simulations. And you see that now the long-run MCMC sampling of the exact posterior matches exactly, I mean, basically exactly what we get out of this approach. Okay, but now what do you do when you don't know how to compute the features on your data set? Let's say, you know, I said you have to compute some set of features which you can then compress, but what if you don't know what features to compute? So here's this IMNN that you heard in the title. This is the information maximizing neural networks. So the goal here is to obviate the need to guess heuristic informative summaries of the data and instead design a neural network that maps the data into a small set of informative summaries, and they're designed to be informative about the parameters of a physical model. You train it with the loss of minus the Fisher information, meaning that you force the Fisher information to get high. So you can think of the Fisher information as an approximation to the mutual information of the summaries and the parameters. But the advantage here is that the Fisher information is a local property that really simplifies the training of these networks. So we've not found this training these to be a problem, even for complicated data models. And I'll show you examples. You train it using physical simulations of the model, and then let the network maximize the information of the summaries of the parameters of the model. And one of the nice features of this is that the achieved loss on the test set is meaningful. It tells you how much information your data set contains about the underlying parameters. So you know how much information the network has found in the data. And I just wanted to point out that it was a paper in a very similar spirit to this that appeared roughly around the same time from the NYU group. So here's the architecture of an information maximizing neural network. An interesting feature here is that you're learning from an ensemble of simulations. So you put in the simulation on this side, you pump it through the network, and you get an output, and the output is your summary statistic that the network decides. And you do that for a set of simulations that allows you to compute a covariance of the outputs, and you also do it for simulations that are displaced in the parameter directions that give you a derivative of the outputs with respect to the underlying parameters, and you can use that to compute the Fisher information of the outputs. So let's see how this works. Here's the simplest nonlinear example. So this is inferring variance from a bunch of Gaussians. So it cannot be linear. For this case, you can do everything analytically, of course. You know that the perfect information should give you a Fisher information of 5. Any linear summary will reduce that. These are 10 Gaussians, so it'll reduce it by a factor of 10 in the best case. You start training this on a set of simulations. It finds Fisher information. It finds 5. Okay, so that you can test that this actually makes sense, is meaningful. Then this is for a simple version of likelihood for inference. We just do forward simulations of the summary with a bunch of true variances and then slice through that. And when you do that, you recover the exact posterior for this case. So this thing has learned that it should calculate something like the sample variance, and that is the sufficient statistic for the variance from a Gaussian sample. Okay, so this is learned statistics 101 automatically. So when you look at what this is against the sample variance, you find that it's sort of a one-to-one map. The width of this is smaller than anything you care about. But one of the cool things about this is that apparently, because we're actually taking a Gaussian noise approximation for the likelihood whose Fisher matrix we maximize, it seems to actually Gaussianize the output. So it applies just automatically a variance stabilizing transformation on this statistic by taking the square root of it. It's not something we designed in, it just happened. This is what now interesting cases are when you have unknown noise. So when the noise is drawn from a wide distribution of possible noise variances, it gives you the exact posterior. Here's an example where we do nonlinear transformations on these outputs. So this is now a case where there isn't any exact analysis. This is a Poisson sort of photon sample noise limited data set that comes from an exponential transformation of a Gaussian random field whose variance you're interested in. So this is an astrophysical use case. And again, you can, here's the likelihood-free inference posterior that is derived from that, and here's the true value, and this shape makes physical sense. Here's an example that we're doing right now using simulated Planck data, which asks how transparent is our universe. Here are three data sets using the Planck data, this entire sky, from simulations with three different values of the transparency of the universe to these photons. The parameter is called tau. And somehow it has to pull out this information from data that looks like this. It's not obvious, I guess, to you or me how to guess from this what the parameters are. Here's what a pure signal simulation looks like. It's a stochastic signal. Different realizations would have completely different structure. It's sort of the shape of the structure that's important. But when you run this through simulated data, again, this is one parameter case, so we just do a very simple classical ABC likelihood for inference. You get a posterior out for this tau parameter. This is a mission that costs $1 billion all told, and this is a fully optimal analysis that was done in roughly order one postdoc days of investment, and the previous analysis involved four mission teams working for about 2 years to get essentially the equivalent output, just to give you a sense of the power of this fairly simple technology. So the latest, there's some updates here that should appear in the archive very shortly in the next days, where we improved the technology for doing the likelihood fitting of this joint PDF, some active learning that decides where to run these simulations. Let me show you a final example before the chair gets up. This is yet another example where we're now looking at photons, as I've shown you in that previous movie, streaming through cosmic density and being lensed. And the key thing about this is that, I have to show this again so you notice, is that a initially round shape of an object actually gets distorted. You can see this profile here actually changes the ellipticity because it's getting sheared essentially as it is being lensed. And an upcoming, so for example, with the Euclid mission, we'll get this lensing information by looking at galaxies at different distances, and we'll build up a tomographic image of the sky, which will allow us to get 3D information about the mass distribution in the universe from this lensing. So this is what the signal looks like. In actual fact, due to the fact that this is the galaxy sits here, you only see parts of the sky. There are all kinds of point sources that need to be masked and so forth. This is a very complicated mask. And then you get noise added. And again, just by purely calculating, these are correlated because they look at the same universe, at the same mass distribution, and these photons coming from the back trace everything, the photons coming from the middle trace only half of it, and so forth. So it's really a tomographic inversion that you would have to do normally. So it's quite it's not a trivial data analysis task. But by simply doing these forward simulations and applying the stuff I've told you about out of the box, you get these inferences about the underlying cosmological parameters, which correspond exactly with what you expect sort of in the optimal case. So here are some details, but I'll just go to the summary, and thank you for your attention.
Great. Thank you very much.
Maybe even more interestingly, that's where the code is.
The code is, yes. Do we have questions? There's one on the back.
So for the compression, you could have equally used something like an autoencoder. But do I understand correctly that the reason that you do, the way that you do it is that you want to specifically keep information that's relevant to the parameters that are being...
That's exactly right. So an autoencoder can respond to any kind of information that is in the data set. So it includes noise, or all kinds of features. And what we're doing here is, because we have these physical models, we're interested, you know, in these non-trivial physical models that depend on the parameters in a complicated way, we actually want to isolate precisely that, those parts of the data, those nonlinear combinations of the data that are sensitive to the physical parameters we're interested in.
So I have another question. So a lot of the systematics in analysis, they come from not quite understanding the statistics of noise, or not knowing how to put, you know, kind of physical priors that are not necessarily Gaussian. So do you think with methods like this, you know, in a few years we'll kind of we'll be in a non-systematic dominated regime in data analysis for astrophysics?
So here, this makes that problem easier. It doesn't solve it out of the box, but it makes it easier because you have a lot more flexibility in specifying a noise model, because as long as you can code it, it's good. You know, it's just, so the likelihood is specified in your simulation code. You change a line of the code and you can rerun it, and then the computer takes care of it. In the previous mode, you have your Bayesian hierarchical model of everything. You then change your noise model. You have to change your sampling strategy. You have to re-implement a new sampler. You have to, you know, it's very time-intensive, and you use a lot of intelligence, human intelligence, and skill to build techniques like this. Whereas this appears to be able to do that in an automated way, as long as you have the forward simulations. So,
as a follow-up to that, in the particle physics side, there's a similar thing, and the quote noise models are simulations of particles with a detector, and there's nothing remotely Gaussian in there, but we have these forward models of them, so it turns into really a modeling of the observations, you know, and so it fits very well in that, in that setting.
So I'm just curious if you have examples of like interesting or relevant forward models for which this IMNN method did not work yet.
not so far. Actually, that's something we've been pushing towards cosmologically motivated cases where we just don't know really how, or we don't have, I mean, we know that very soon it will be very difficult to build these bespoke statistical analysis techniques to do things optimally. And in most of those cases, that we've tried, it just works. But actually, there's, in the back of my mind, there's a project where I just want to put in something with a very complicated. You could imagine, for example, if you make the joint PDF of the data and the model parameters extremely multimodal, for example, with widely separated peaks, that in such situations you might run into problems because we are using essentially an asymptotic regime where we're training these summaries around some fiducial model. So that could be a way that, but the nice thing about the setup here is that the information maximizing network, this compression technique, is in both the data chain and it is in the simulation chain. So even if you fail, like the worst failure mode you could possibly get is where the compression is very bad, in which case you lose all information, but you will never come to a situation where you conclude the wrong thing.
Right, so because just precision, these models that you were trying it on, they are all deterministic.
No, they're not deterministic. For example,
for given parameters, they end up in a given place, or is there noise?
Because first of all, there are nuisance parameters, so there are parts about the instrument that you don't know, so those, you vary those in the simulations within a range of possibilities.
Also, if this noise is big enough, it should not work. I mean, there should
Why?
Be some. I mean,
no,
there should
you,
be some
I mean,
regime
the summary
where the noise is.
You have to learn that it has to be
insensitive
to variations in that subspace of data.
Okay, let's stop. Yeah.
So, if I can say what I think you would agree with, but you have a stochastic generative model, so it's stochastic. And you're trying to find, you know, these summaries, this compression that you're looking for, these sort of optimal, is this score, which is only sufficient in very locally, right? So if you have the score is only a sufficient statistic in an exponential family of models. Most of these things are not in the exponential family. They're super complicated simulators, but very close to some, you know, pick some point in your parameter space, very close to that, you know, it's approximately, exponential, you can, and so the score is a good summary statistic in that neighborhood. But if you go to a different part of the parameter space than that, those summaries might not be sufficient anymore. And then his point is that it might not be sufficient, but your statistical inference technique should not be overly optimistic. You know, you'll always kind of have the right coverage probabilities. Your Bayesian stuff will be, you know, will be correct. But you put, you know, the locally it's putting a formal bound on like how well you can estimate these things. So, but you can calibrate it by running the forward model some more. So to the extent that the forward model is accurate, you can still calibrate everything, and you're just losing statistical power.
So yes, thank you for rephrasing my answer. And also, there's another step that you can do when, let's say, you start off in completely the wrong neighborhood, and you get suboptimal summaries. You will still get some information. I mean, the likelihood for inference will give you a posterior PDF. It might not be as sharp as you as possible, but it might not be completely optimal, but it will still be centered somewhere near the true maximum. And so you can then update the analysis and rerun at a new point and get presumably better summaries. So we've seen this in some cases where when we initialize the intentionally initialize very, very far away from the fiducial model, so when it put the fiducial model very far from the true model in simulations, then but typically after one iteration of this, we get optimal results. So that has happened.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in some experiments we did with this like Latka-Volterra system, if you move very far away, what it learned was like totally useless. And then so we did come up with failure scenarios in a slightly different variant, you know, so where the summaries it learned were not useful at all. Like, but in cosmology, I think, you know, you kind of have a good idea of where you are roughly. And in particle physics, you have a reasonable good idea of where you are. But if you're in a model where things change a lot and you have no idea what the true value is, then it can fail. Yeah. If what?
If the system was chaotic.
Ah, yeah.
Oh, but I mean, the nature of, I mean, even if it's chaotic, right, you might be able to tell the parameters of the system from the nature of the attractor that you're exploring, right? The attractor has a certain shape, and that could be informative about the parameters. So it doesn't have to be, you know, it's not like you have an image and changing the parameter changes a feature in the image. The change in the parameter can change the shape or the, you know, it doesn't have to, you know, it can be a stochastic set. So the distribution of the data can change under changes in the parameters, and we find, yeah.
If I'm interested in the initial condition and the system is chaotic, then yeah. I will not get it, right? I mean, I'm not saying that it doesn't work in the cases you showed. It clearly works. I'm just interested, what are the limitations there? Surely a hard...
So the limitations are that you will never do better than what a full, you know, fully implemented Bayesian hierarchical model would give you. I mean, and if you have any sort of noise in a chaotic system and you're interested in reconstructing the initial conditions, then there's going to be a fundamental limit to what information you can get out, absolutely. But I wouldn't call it a failure mode of this. The idea of this is to reproduce, in the best case, what a fully implemented Bayesian hierarchical model would do. The magic of this is not that it does better than information theory allows. The magic of this is that it does, you know, surprisingly well and gets very close to what information theory allows.
Right, but information theory is one thing, right? But you're doing it computationally efficiently. You're not trying to tell me that like everything that can be done information theoretically can also be done computationally efficiently, right? There must be examples where it can be done in exponential time, but your method is not doing it because it's just,
right,
you know, fast polynomial method or linear method. So that's what I'm saying.
So in this case, one thing that we do take, I mean, this is used, so far we've been using this for continuous parameters, for example. I mean, the parameter space is continuous. When you have a search space that is discrete, for example, and where the model changes completely as to, you know, where you are in the set of discrete settings, I think that will be a case because we're, you know, we're using, some level, we're using smoothness of the PDFs as part of the model, but even there, I think you could possibly generalize this by you know, in principle, you can make this non-asymptotic. Rather than expanding around some place in the parameter space, you could compute the mutual information of the data and of these compressed summaries and the entire, and the parameters over the entire range of the parameters. That would be computationally more costly, but I mean, that's an interesting thing to. That's definitely on my list of things to try. Yeah. There's another question earlier over here.
You talk about uncertainties a little bit. Well, actually, I had two questions. You were showing the simulations a couple slides ago with the lensing masks.
Yes.
Are those also simulated, or
no, the masks are set by the for example, the fact that we live in a galaxy, and so the galaxy obscures. The galaxy obscures, a large part of the sky. So you can't look through the galaxy. This is the southern hemisphere, the northern hemisphere. There's, scheduling issues about the instrument, how it observes the sky. There are bright point sources nearby that you have to exclude because you need to have clear fields in order to be able to really measure the shapes of the galaxies in order to get the weak lensing shear.
Exclude a minimal set of stuff, but they're well known.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. I'm interested in things like handles to some known quantity, or something like that to check whether you have some effect there that you don't know about in your simulation.
Uh-huh.
So do you have any examples of predictions to some independent measurable or observable that you can make with some of these?
You can definitely do, but because you're working in a generative model context here, you can then take the parameter inferences and do posterior predictive checks, for example. You can run your sample from this posteriors that you get, run simulations forward, and then compute whatever features you want that maybe you didn't, and look at how they compare with the same features computed on the data. So you can then evaluate the model. Or another interesting aspect of this is that it turns out that evidence calculations, if you want to go all the way in the Bayesian framework, you can compare different models using evidence. And actually evidence calculation here becomes integrating over the parameters for these joint PDFs actually becomes simple because you have this full joint this joint PDF. So at least in certain model classes, it becomes very simple to calculate evidence if you want to use that as for model comparison. But the idea really is to have physically motivated models that you can then compare. Where in each case you can do this forward generation. Even though we've been having some conversations about is there some automatic way you could discover additional effects in the data that are not part of the models? And I think your question probably goes along that line. Yeah.
Okay, we have maybe time for one more question. Okay. Otherwise, one last one.
Different one. So you said that you have really good physics idea about what the models are, but it might be that they are not completely exact because there is just some maybe part of the physics that we are still missing in these various things. So is there a way, would this kind of approach kind of tell you some sign of that? Or
right, so this goes in what we were just discussing, I guess, that if there was some way of adding a feature, if there was some way of finding information in the data that is not explained, where there's signal to noise, but it's not explained by the parameters of the model. So if there was some generic way of so you could imagine maybe putting an autoencoder around this, where some of the features you supply by the summaries that are being computed by the physics-based analysis, and then then ask for generic additional features that that help explain the data. I just worry that maybe a lot of those would then basically be about characterizing the noise, but it might be, maybe there's aspects that would show up that would find in string physics. But you know, what you're asking for is essentially an automatic scientist. So this is an automatic statistician. the next step is to make an automatic scientist. it's very, very interesting, but it's also a tall order.
Okay, thank you, Bertrand.
So as you have seen, the next item in the program, well, is the coffee break. But in half an hour, there is a discussion planned. So please come back. We will have some interesting people sitting in front, and we will be asking them questions, and you will be asking them questions, and hopefully it will be interesting. This just might be Florence. Yeah, I think so. Looks like.